Hello, everybody. Welcome to a new episode of the Dissenter. I'm your host, Ricardo Lopes, and today I'm joined by Dr. Ethan Porter. He's an assistant professor at the George Washington University School of Media and Public Affairs. And today we're going to talk about his new book, The Consumer Citizen, which investigates the ways in which everyday consumer decision-making affects political attitudes and behavior. Dr. Porter, welcome to the show. It's a pleasure to have you
It's great to be here. Thank you for having me.
on. Okay, great. So, I mean, what would you say is the basic premise of your book? What is the thesis?
Sure. The book investigates the idea that when it comes to politics, many people are disengaged and uninformed to such an extent that they actually rely on their consumer decision-making habits and practices when they have to make political decisions. So the basic thesis is, for most people, not the people listening to this or watching this, I'm sure, for most people, politics is something they do rarely and infrequently. Instead, they spend a lot of time shopping, thinking about what to buy, what not to buy, how much they're willing to spend. And the frequency of those consumer decisions gives them certain habits and techniques that then come to shape how they behave and think politically in ways that are surprising. That's the basic argument.
Yeah, and we're going to talk about some of those ways, but before that, does that happen because people are not really that politically engaged or well informed?
Yeah, I think it happens for both of those reasons. I think as politically informed people, we tend to overestimate how politically informed and engaged other people are, when in fact, for most people, politics is something they dabble in from time to time. Perhaps they vote when requested to do so. But fundamentally, people spend more time shopping. That's borne out by empirical evidence. And that might be surprising, you might say. Oh gosh, if only people spent more time thinking about politics and engaging in civic and political life, then the world would be different. And maybe so, but that's not the case. And part of the book is a call to be realistic about how people approach politics and how infrequently they think about politics.
But is it that people are influenced by their, let's say, everyday consumer behavior in how they think and behave in the political realm because there are certain traits that both of those worlds share? Or, I mean, because I was imagining that it could be that other aspects of their lives would also have some influence on politics. So, why are you focusing here on their consumer behavior?
Absolutely. Consumer behavior is but one thing, one sort of domain of behavior that people engage with outside of politics. Why do I focus on it? I focus on it primarily because it's been so underappreciated as a source of political views and behavior. Oftentimes, scholars ask questions like, how do people's political views shape their consumer behavior? But I think if you just look at how much time people spend on consuming and thinking about consumption, it should actually go the other way around. In fact, and I think that's sort of one possible and almost believable implication of the empirical data on time usage. The second reason I focus on consumer behavior is because not only is it underappreciated, but it in terms of politics, but I think it's underappreciated in general, the way in which the ubiquity of consumer decision making sort of leaves a mark on how people think and behave when they are not technically making consumer decisions.
Yeah, I think that one type of things that government provides people with and that are people really do consume is services. So would that be a good example of something that perhaps would induce people to think about political services as consumer goods, for example?
Yes, absolutely. I think it's when it comes to government services and government benefits, direct benefits, that's an area of government activity that is ripe for exploitation by our consumer minds. And for better or worse, depending on your point of view, there's robust, longstanding evidence that people have trouble actually understanding the benefits that government provides as originating from government. And to the consumer citizen, that poses certain problems. If people have trouble connecting the benefits that government provides, then for many people, government will appear to be a bad deal or an unfair deal.
Mm-hmm. Right. But, I mean, does the arrow also point the other direction? So, for example, does politics also influence consumer behavior?
Yes, absolutely. And I think there's good reason to think, there's good empirical evidence that, you know, people become more excited to spend when their party wins. And of course, people will direct some of their spending to companies that they believe align with their political views. But that kind of relationship is conditional on people being pretty in tune with what's going on politically, right? So if I say, hey, I'm going to only shop at Coca-Cola because they took a certain political stance I like, that requires me to know what political stance Coca-Cola took, and it requires me to have an understanding of my own political views. That's actually requiring a lot of me. For many people, I'm skeptical of the idea that they think about politics that often and are that impassioned to make those kinds of decisions. So they do indeed happen.
Mm-hmm. But are there aspects of people's consumer behavior that influence more specific things, like, for example, their voting behavior, the sorts of candidates they prefer, the parties they support, and things like that?
So, right. So your question is, to what extent does consumer behavior then shape? Yes. So I think this is where the consumer citizen really, I think, makes a contribution, where when it comes to how people think about taxes, when it comes to how people think about government services, healthcare candidates, there's evidence that I present in the book that all of those kinds of political decisions appear to operate similarly to typical consumer decisions. So can I give you an example?
Mm-hmm, sure.
So here's one example that I like quite a bit. Corporations, large corporations, have known for some time that to really convince customers that what they're doing, that it's in their interest to sell goods as fairly priced, right? They want to convince consumers that, look, you're getting a good deal for your money. And in the book, I show that people don't often think that about government, but B, when government services are described as fair, people can actually become more supportive of government, more willing to pay taxes, and more willing to sort of buy into government. There are certain areas that are ripe. There are certain areas of government activity that are ripe for this kind of thinking, but that also suggests that if government were to tweak how it presents itself to people, then people could respond differently to government.
Mm-hmm. So there are people that say that whatever people do, it's always in the realm of politics, that all decisions are political decisions in a way. But is that really true? Are all individual choices we make political choices?
Yeah, I think that's a great question. Well, let me put it like this. I think you could make an argument that all choices are political choices. You could say that every decision we ever make in life has political repercussions, and you could convince me of that. But I think that, you know, many choices we make are quotidian. They're everyday. They're sort of, you know, we figure out what we're having for lunch. We're figuring out what time we're going to do something. We have to think through, you know, how we're getting to work. You know, these sort of everyday mundane decisions certainly outstrip the number of major political decisions we make. What party do you support? How do you feel about government spending? These are epic political decisions. Those are pretty rare comparatively, I think, to everyday decisions. So I would shy away from recasting all decisions as political. Though again, you could convince me philosophically that that's the case, but I think I'd have to be convinced.
Okay, so Thorstein Veblen introduced the concept of conspicuous consumption. Is there any equivalent to that in politics? So, for example, is it that some of the political decisions people make are a sort of social signal?
Well, first of all, I love that you bring up Veblen, because Veblen is sort of the undercurrent of a lot of the consumer citizen. I mention him here and there in the book, but he's a major inspiration for this work. And as you know, and as your viewers know, Veblen had this idea that, you know, we're not just consuming to consume, but we also consume to send signals to others. Do we make political decisions similarly? I think the answer is yes, especially when it comes to some very basic forms of political participation. So there's been a longstanding question, why is it that people vote? Why is it that people vote when they're almost never going to be the decisive vote? Why is it that people vote when not only are they unlikely to be decisive, but, you know, they often know little about the candidates, they have difficulty tracing out the effects of politicians' decision on their own lives? And the best answer to that question has been that people vote to maintain and the esteem they enjoy in the eyes of others. People vote because of social pressure. People vote when they believe that their neighbors will judge them for not voting, that they vote instead. That's what the best evidence shows. And to me, that suggests actually how unmotivated people are intrinsically to take political action. Though we might want them to, and we might say, oh, no, it's people should vote. Democracy requires them to vote. That may all be true, but the best evidence suggests that people vote because, not out of a sense of civic duty, but because of peer pressure, basically, precisely in ways that Veblen would have anticipated.
Mm-hmm. But, I mean, let's talk now about ordinary people, and by that I mean people who are not really that knowledgeable and not particularly politically engaged. I mean, does them behaving like citizens help them in any way, or is it something simply harmful?
Behaving as consumers?
Mm-hmm. In okay. The realm of politics.
Yes. So, again, it's, you know, so whether or not relying on consumer techniques to make political decisions helps or hurts you depends on what you want. So I'll give you an example. I'll give you two examples. So in the book, I show that when government-provided health insurance is described as meeting the standards of consumer fairness, people become more likely to actually enroll in those health insurance programs. So that seems, I think, pretty good. I think people, you may disagree, other people may disagree, but having health insurance seems like a good thing. And as I show in the book, we can increase the number of people enrolled in government-provided health insurance by appealing to them as consumer citizens. So that's the helpful way, but there's potential harm too. I found in the book multiple experiments that people who are less politically knowledgeable seem to want out of their political candidates to give them what I call cost-benefit alignability. People who are less politically knowledgeable, who are less politically engaged, prefer political candidates who are giving them roughly an equal amount of government benefits, equal to the amount of taxes they paid. They prefer that kind of political candidate over a political candidate who promises them far more benefits than the amount of taxes they paid in. That pattern to me suggests that relying on consumer thinking can also undercut people's self-interest. It can come at the expense of people's self-interest. So, I think And I think that's bad. I think we want people to have more than we want people to, you know, more is better than less. Usually when we think about self-interest, and it seems that consumer principles lead those who are less politically knowledgeable and less likely to rely on them to undercut their own self-interest.
Mm-hmm. And what about the people who are more knowledgeable and more politically engaged? Do they behave the same way or not?
Yeah, so that's really interesting. So what I also found is that people who are really politically knowledgeable, who know a lot about politics, who are engaged in, you know, political life regularly, those people are distinct because they are better at preferring candidates who realize their self-interest. So that's, I think, quite interesting, because it seems that with political knowledge comes an ability to comes an enhanced ability to support politicians who benefit you personally. So that's distinct from people who are less knowledgeable, who are okay, or so it would seem across repeated experiments, with supporting candidates who are fine undercutting, you know, their supporters' self-interest.
But in this case, self-interest, we're talking about individual self-interest, right?
Yes.
It doesn't necessarily mean that it's good for the collective.
Absolutely. You know, that's a great point. You know, in these studies, for the sake of what you might think of as really trying to understand a concept really narrowly, I often would zoom in and manipulate self-interest just as it pertains to how individuals are taxed and how individuals receive government benefits themselves personally. You know, I think the question of public goods is a great one, but in the studies I was just talking about, I sort of left them out, not because I don't find them interesting, on the contrary, but I just wanted to zoom in on them specifically.
Right. And do we know if governments tend to spend their taxpayers' money wisely?
Yeah, I think that's another great question. I think even getting into a debate about that question, a real rigorous debate, requires knowing, you know, certain facts that are actually hard to come by, right? You have to sort of find out, well, what is government, you know, how much money does government spend? How much are people taxed? And then what do they spend that money on, right? So there are different things all working at once. Many people would say that government doesn't spend money wisely, but not really have a good understanding of what it is that government spends that money on. With that in mind, I think there's really good reason to make people understand what government spends their money on better. You know, and that's sort of where I come down on this in the book.
And do we know, I mean, perhaps here we would need to focus on a particular country, like, for example, the United States. Do we know if the taxes people pay, if what they contribute to the state is less than the benefits they get from it, or the other way around?
Well, it depends on how you measure benefits, right? So this is a great question. This is something that I've wrestled with a lot. So in general, so you can think of benefits in two ways. You can think of benefits as being the direct government benefits that you receive, you know, so whether that's literal support from the government in the form of healthcare, Social Security, you know, retirement contributions, and even, you know, say support for public education, those all count as sort of measurable benefits the government provides. But then there are these immeasurable benefits that are just as important, but in some ways more important. So, for instance, how could we quantify meaningfully the benefit of national security, national defense? Now, we could add up the amount spent, divide it by the number of people in the country, and then we'd have a number, but it still doesn't actually really tell us much of anything, because, you know, the value of not being killed is quite large. So I think it's really hard to do that kind of cost-benefit analysis for the whole of government. And, you know, you can do it, but I think the results aren't particularly meaningful. What I would say, though, is as a rejoinder to that skepticism, is look, it's precisely the difficulties around doing that kind of cost-benefit analysis that make understanding the consumer citizen so important, okay? Because if people are thinking as consumers, when they think about government, they might only calculate or add up in their heads those few benefits they see in their day-to-day lives without accounting for all the other benefits that government is providing them that become really hard to measure, which is why I think government has trouble dealing with the reality of consumer citizens.
Mm-hmm. Right. And I mean, there are also perhaps some public goods, which is very hard to quantify exactly the kinds of impact by government providing them. I mean, how much people are spending how much people do not have to spend on those particular kinds of services because the government allows for them. Like, for example, I know roads, hospitals, schools, and all of those kinds of things, right?
Right, exactly. It's not only hard for people to appreciate those public goods as public goods, it's also hard for people to appreciate that they played a role in making that public good possible. That's often under-discussed in the literature and in politics, right? It's like, you know, so if you remember a few years ago, there's a big controversy in U.S. politics when Elizabeth Warren said, you know, you didn't build the roads, you didn't. She was speaking to a wealthy supporter who opposed taxes, and she said, "You didn't build the roads. You didn't build this." But in fact, that supporter did. Everyone did. Public goods only exist because of the contributions of individuals. That's often lost.
Right. Right. So is consumer behavior or the concept of the consumer citizen in any way a threat to democracy?
Well, I think, you know, I'm of two minds on this. On the one hand, of course it's the case that consumer citizenship seems at odds with our classical notions of democratic citizenship. Indebted to the ancient Greeks, I think we all still think of democracy as being about people coming together and debating at length the issues of the day. And consumer citizenship says, well, that's not really true for most people. But this is where this is the second level of this. I believe that we can actually leverage consumer citizenship to enhance democracy. And I think that has to be done. And on that point, I would say we have to get creative about connecting democracy to the places where people shop. So you could imagine an online store such as Amazon or another kind of online store connecting people directly to their government. You could imagine governments going into markets, marketplaces, et cetera, and setting up booths or stands to explain to people what it is that government does. Consumer citizenship can benefit democracy if government is willing to come down and meet the people where they are. Where they are, they tend to be shopping. They tend to be buying stuff. And government should go there.
Right. And I mean, let me just ask you about the specific topic. How does people's consumer behavior affect how they think about economic redistribution?
Yeah, that's a great question. When I struggle with a lot in the book and thinking through. I think the real answer is, support for redistribution can be changed based on the kinds of appeals that government makes and the extent to which those appeals match the precepts of consumer fairness. So at one point in the book, I show that when government appeals to people as consumer citizens by highlighting the services that it provides, people become more supportive of redistribution. They become more supportive of taxation and government spending. But again, the flip side to that is when politicians are speaking to consumer citizens, and consumer citizens understood here as people who are not particularly engaged in politics, who spend far more of their lives, more time in their lives shopping and buying than thinking about politics. Those politicians can engender opposition to redistribution. So again, I think it depends on the question of redistribution and support for it hangs on the extent to which people are spoken to in consumer terms.
So in the book, you use the concept of alignability, and you talk specifically about cost-benefit alignability and source-use alignability. Could you explain that?
Yeah, so this is one of the concepts that I was sort of most excited about while writing the book, and one of the concepts that I think has the most sort of power in explaining the relationship between redistribution and consumer citizenship. So source-use alignability works as follows. Source-use alignability says people are going to be more supportive of taxes when they believe the use of those taxes will be aligned with the source of that tax's collection. So, for example, if people are taxed on, the gas they put in their car, they are more supportive of that tax if they are then told that that tax will be used to pay for highway construction and highway maintenance than they would be if they were told that the tax on gas will be used to pay for something totally unrelated to highway construction. That's true with several kinds of taxes. So source use alignability, when taxes achieve source use alignability, support for taxes go up, and people are even willing to pay higher taxes when they're told that that tax that the source and use will be aligned. So that's source use alignability. There's then cost benefit alignability, and this is basically achieved when people are told that the amount of taxes they paid for a particular government service or the amount of taxes they paid for all government services aligns with the benefits they received from government. Right. So, for example, in the book, I show that people who are told that the cost of a city bus, the cost to ride a city bus, is about the same as what government spends each time they ride a city bus, which actually turned out to be basically true in the city of Chicago when I wrote the book. So this was convenient. I literally was telling bus riders this, you know, using a random experimental design, finding out that telling them about source use alignability actually made them like taxes more.
That's really interesting. So, I mean, and I guess that related to that, could you tell us about taxpayer receipts? What are those?
Sure. So taxpayer receipts are sort of the origin of the book. I'm really going to date myself here, but I'd say about 12 years ago, I had an idea, you know, just thinking up late at night one night, I said, gosh, it was the first time I paid taxes, I think, paid a large amount of taxes. And I said, gosh, I wish I knew where my tax money was going. And it dawned on me that it's really hard to know that. And it also dawned on me that one way of achieving that would be just giving people a receipt, and the same kind of receipt you get when you buy a sandwich. A taxpayer receipt works by showing people on an individual per capita basis where their tax money went. So let's say you paid $1,000 one year in taxes, and 25% of the of government spending was allocated toward defense. Your taxpayer receipt would say, of that $1,000 in taxes, $250 went to defense. That's the basic idea behind a receipt, giving people a per capita window on how their tax money is spent.
Mm-hmm. And do these taxpayer receipts work? Do they have the sort of effects you would want?
Well, depends. It depends. So the exciting thing is, and I describe this in the book, so Obama, President Obama, took up taxpayer receipts. He introduced them for 2 years. You go onto the White House website and see your taxpayer receipt. In the United Kingdom, the government actually mailed out taxpayer receipts. This was quite exciting. When I studied taxpayer receipts empirically, I found two results, one of which was exciting, one of which was a bit deflating. The exciting result is that taxpayer receipts do indeed make people more aware of where their tax money is going, right? So people sort of learn from taxpayer receipts. That's exciting. But taxpayer receipts don't have any effects on attitudes. They don't affect people's trust in government, support for redistribution, etc. So it's interesting. In the U.S., proponents of the taxpayer receipt believed that the taxpayer receipt would increase trust in government. In the United Kingdom, the politicians who supported the idea believed it would decrease trust in government. It turns out that both camps were wrong. Taxpayer receipts, while they're pretty good at actually making people more knowledgeable about the use of their taxes, not so good at affecting people's attitudes one way or another.
But why is that? Is it because, I mean, when people know where their money gets spent, they basically get to learn that the government is not spending their money where they want?
Yeah, that's also a great question. The why is harder to answer. And there are really two whys I have to offer. The first why is, why is the taxpayer receipt good at educating people? Because it is good. There are lots of efforts to many attempts to improve people's political knowledge fail. The taxpayer receipt does not fail. That's exciting, and I think it works because it comes in the form of a receipt that they're familiar with, right? So everyone's sort of, you know how to read a receipt, you get lots of practice in it. So that's why it works on knowledge. Why doesn't it work on attitudes? I think, and this corresponds with other research I've done, that basically people's political views are not just the byproduct of adding up a bunch of facts. That's not really how people form their political beliefs. They form them because of the ways in which the messages they receive correspond with their predetermined beliefs. So in this case, in this book, as I show, people walk into the political world as consumers, and they have lots of beliefs about consumption and what counts as a fair price, what doesn't count as a fair price. Then they get messages from the government and from politicians that then interact with their beliefs about consumption, which in turn shape their final outcome. I think facts alone, in those ways conveyed by the consumer, by the taxpayer receipt, just don't do enough to move the needle.
Do you think that if it would do any good if it was possible for government to give people the possibility of them deciding where their money is spent in terms of the services government provides us with?
Yeah, so this is an idea that there's a professor at Wharton, Kate Lamberton, Dr. Kate Lamberton, has looked at this extensively and found that basically the answer is yes. When you get to choose where your tax money goes, that generally makes you like the process more. I don't look at that in the book. I think it's a really intriguing idea. And I think, although it's you might imagine it'd be difficult to make work in practice. Government spending is enormous and requires some foresight and planning. So perhaps a workable version of choosing where your tax money goes, you know, could account for, say, a small percentage of your total tax bill.
Mm-hmm. So there are another two concepts you talk about in the book that I would like to ask you about, starting with consumer fairness. What is it and how does it get translated into politics?
Sure. So consumer fairness is an idea that I just love. I think about it all the time. It's indebted, you know, it's an idea pioneered by Richard Thaler, Daniel Kahneman, both of whom, you know, since won the Nobel Prize since they started writing about this idea, not just because of this idea, though, to be clear. And the basic idea is as follows. People have certain expectations about what a firm is offering them in terms of price and what that price is reflective of. People are willing to bear cost increases in the form of an increased price if they believe that cost increase is in the price increases that the price increase is owed to sort of a legitimate cost increase. So for example, if I'm selling shovels and it's snowing outside, I'll be, you know, people will not like me a lot if I then jack up the price of shovels. But if, say, the price of shovels has just gone up through no fault of my own, then people might be more willing to pay the increased price. Again, people understand that, you know, people are willing to grant companies a profit. All this is to say that when it comes to politics, people's expect government to also achieve some semblance of consumer fairness. They want governments to sort of bill them or give them tax charges that are roughly equivalent in value to what they put in. They want government to be fair with them. And politicians, interestingly, understand the importance of fairness in this way. This is why, you know, we have in the United States, we constantly have had politicians invoking the Fair Deal, the New Deal, right? The constantly versions of the constantly instances of politicians communicating the fairness of what government is providing. Politicians understand the importance of fairness and consumer fairness specifically more so than I think social scientists do. I think scholars of politics have missed this. The final thing I'll say about consumer fairness, it's not the way in which we typically think of fairness in political contexts, right? We have ideas of fairness, you know, inherited from John Rawls and great philosophers that I don't actually think correspond to how people think about fairness in their day-to-day lives as consumers, and then therefore don't really correspond to how they think about fairness in their day-to-day lives or in their those rare occasions when they are politically engaged.
Yeah. What about operational transparency? What is that about?
Yeah, operational transparency is a more recent idea than consumer fairness, but similar. Operational transparency is from the marketing literature. And operational transparency says that when firms are transparent about their operations, people become more trusting and supportive of those firms and more, in fact, even eager to buy from those firms. So this, in part, is why companies' advertising strategies often involve convincing you, but all the effort they've put into giving you services, giving you the goods that you buy from them. And, you know, I think there's a similar that operational transparency can be applied to government. We can apply operational transparency to government services, making clear all the benefits that government provides to people and the effort that goes into providing those services. And as I show, when that's done, people become more supportive and trusting of government and even more supportive of redistribution. So operational transparency, like consumer fairness, is a concept from the marketing literature that can be applied successfully to government and politics.
Mm-hmm. So considering the fact that different people have different needs and they allocate money differently for different areas, is it in any way possible for them to really objectively evaluate if their government is spending their money wisely or not?
You know, I would be skeptical that anybody could make a purely objective, wholly empirical evaluation of how government is spending their money. It would be difficult to imagine any evaluation that doesn't depend on people's normative beliefs. That being said, I think it's always better to rely on more evidence rather than less. People can make more informed decisions rather than less informed decisions. I think we want people to be better educated and more knowledgeable than they would be. In some cases, it's not, you know, you can learn a lot of useless information, but there's some sort of basic facts that I think are useful to know. Just basic facts about spending, basic facts about, the tax burden. Those are useful facts. That might inform how you view government spending. You know, and whether or not you're pro or anti, I think it's nice to at least tether your beliefs to some shared empirical base.
Mm-hmm. So we've already talked about taxpayer receipt specifically. Would putting people in a consumer mind frame, let's say, help them in any way in dealing with political decisions?
I think the answer is maybe. I think there's mixed evidence. I think putting people in a consumer mindset or really tapping into the consumer mindset they already have can, you know, sometimes, as I showed the example of the taxpayer receipt, can make them better informed, but then doesn't change their decision making after that. So that's I guess good to know. Again, people should be better informed. But whether or not it helps to make better decisions, I would circle back to the healthcare issue, right? Where I think there's strong evidence in the book through a field experiment conducted with an actual provider of government health insurance that appealing to people's penchant for consumer fairness really can convince them to enroll in health insurance. That's unusual, and I think that's that approach of appealing to fairness has not been tried out, at least routinely in the United States, when it comes to enrolling in government health insurance.
Mm-hmm. So would you say that you're not particularly against or for people behaving like consumers in the realm of politics? I mean, perhaps what you're trying to say is that it depends perhaps on the kinds of issues we're dealing with, and you're more interested in people making wise decisions, whether they're doing it as consumers or otherwise.
Sure. I think there's a book a few years back called Democracy for Realists. And Democracy for Realists marshals evidence to show, look, we might have expectations about how citizens behave in democracy. Those expectations are not met. My book, I think, sort of builds on that. My approach builds on that and just says, okay, that's true. Citizens are not behaving as we might want them to be. But where does that leave us? So whether or not I would like citizens to be consumer citizens or not is almost beside the point, right? I am just but one boat in a very large ocean. Instead, I think we can use consumer citizenship to try and enhance the quality of democracy and enhance people's political decision making, right? So rather than just, being really angry about the rise of consumer citizenship and saying, oh gosh, if only people spent more time thinking about politics and if only they were as concerned about democracy as we wanted them to be, the world would be better. It's like, well, no, that's, that's likely not going to accomplish anything. Instead, let's use consumer citizenship to try and make politics, government, and civic life a little better off.
Mm-hmm. So let me just ask you one last question. What would be the kind of good effects you would want for your book to have on people who read it?
Yeah, so I think that's a great question. So a few positive outcomes that could come from the book. First of all, if you're reading the book and if you're listening to this show, you likely are not a consumer citizen. I think that's important to understand. In coming to appreciate the distance between your own level of engagement in politics and the level of engagement that most people have, I think that's one positive outcome. I think that alone would be nice. Secondarily, if you're in a position where you might be able to influence how governments behave or how corporations behave vis-a-vis citizenship, that too might have positive knock-on effects. If you say, look, as a decision maker in government, I'm going to try and talk to people as consumer citizens, or as a corporate leader, I might take it upon myself to try and connect what I do to people's civic life. I think both of those outcomes would be really nice and well off. And the third one I would say is, as a general approach, don't simply bemoan the rise of consumer citizenship, but try and use it to enhance the quality of democracy and enhance the political decision-making of your fellow citizens.
Mm-hmm. Great. Okay, so the book is again The Consumer Citizen. Just before we go, where can people find you on the internet?
Sure. I can be found at my website is ethanporter.com. That website details all my work. It has links to my academic articles. It has links to my books. This is my second book. This is the book that represents the culmination of many years of work. Mm-hmm. And people can always drop me a line over email too. I love to hear from readers, and I hear from them pretty regularly.
Yeah, great. Yeah. I will be leaving links to all of that in the description box of the interview. And Dr. Porter, it's been a real pleasure to talk to you. Thank you for coming on the show.
Thank you so much. Be well.
Hello, everybody. Thank you for watching this interview until the end. So it is thanks to people like you that the show has been running for such a long time, more than 3 years now. And I would like to ask you to please pay a visit to my Patreon page and to consider making a pledge there. If you prefer PayPal, you can also find links to it in the description box of the interview. Otherwise, and if you like what I'm doing, please share the interview, leave a like, hit the subscription button, and comment on it. This show is brought to you by Enlights, the learning and development done differently. Check their website at enlights.com. I would also like to give a huge thank you to my main patrons and PayPal supporters, Karen Litzke and Blanchett Perga, Larson Lau Guerrero, Francis Ford, Hans Frederick Sunda, Ricardo Vladimiro, Craig Healy, Adam Castle, Olaf Alex, Jonathan Wiesel, Jacob Klinkby, Matthew Whitting, Bernardo Wolf, Tim Hollis, Henrik Alenius, John Connors, Paulina Barron, Philip Force Connolly, Jerry Mueller, Herbert Gintis, Rutger Bosbo, Weingard, Becker, Neuberger, Goldstein, Dan Demetriou, Robert Windegger, Rui Inácio, Arthur Coe, Zup, Marco Neves, Colin Holbrook, Susan Pinker, Thomas Trumbull, Bernardo Seixas, Pablo Santurbano, Simon Columbus, George Pinha, Phil Kavanagh, Corey Clark, Mark Blythe, Roberto Inguanzo, Michael Stormir, Eric Neumann, Samuel Andreev, Tiago Nunes, Bernard Hugni, Alexander Dunbauer, Omari Hickson, Fergal Cusson, Evan Bodrenko, Ala Herzog, Don Ross, Jonathan Librant, Oslan Bullet, Nathan Nguyen, Stanton T, Samuel Correa, Eric Hines, Mark Smith, J.W., João Weira, Tom Hummel, David Sloan Wilson, Yacila Dez Araújo, Eden Solon, Romain Roach, Dmitry Grigoriev, Diego Londoño Correa, Tom Roth, Yannick Punter, Adana Rusmani, Charlotte Bliss, Miren B., Nicole Barbaro, Adam Hunt, Pavel Ostasevsky, Max Bailby, Nelek Bach, Catherine and Patrick Tobin, Al Ortiz, Guy Madison, Gary G. Allman, my producers, Izar Webb, Jim Frank, Lucas Tafiniak, Ian Gilligan, Sergio Quadriano, Luis Caetano, Tom Van Agdam, Curtis Dixon, João Linhares, Benedict Mueller, Vega Guidi, Sardis France, and Niroban Balachandran, and my executive producers, Michel Rugieski, Rosie, James Pratt, and Matthew Lavender. Thank you for all.